Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Tonight we'll hear from a physician who rushed to Nepal to provide medical care after that devastating earthquake.
The biggest one was the collapsing building, the weak building. And of course, Nepal is a mountainous country, so dry landslide was also rampant.
Plus, that scary sounding cough is croup. What can you do about it?
The current evidence in the literature does not support that cool mist or that steam therapy.
And the evolution of end-of-life care from the perspective of a hospice medical director.
It's essentially to relieve the suffering that people have with either illness that may be threatening their life or for those who are actually at the end of their life.
What to do when the elderly have a fall and a new piece from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, when that scary-sounding croup turns scary, what do parents need to do? Plus, the evolving story of hospice and the comfort it brings to dying patients and their families. But first, a medical mission to earthquake-stricken Nepal. When the devastating earthquake hit Nepal in April, Dr. Dinesh Subedi knew he needed to return to provide help to the country of his birth. Joined by four of his Nepalese medical school colleagues, who are also practicing in the United States, he made his way there armed with expertise and supplies that he had gathered from donations. Dr. Dinesh Subedi, assistant professor of medicine at Upstate Medical University, joins us now to tell us more. Welcome, Dr. Subedi. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So you went back to Nepal. Well, tell us about it. When did you go? How long did you stay?
So the earthquake happened on April 25th, on midday of Nepali time. As soon as we knew about it, I was deeply hurt. And I made my mind immediately that I needed to be there after getting the initial information. And so did four of my other friends who are here in the United States practicing medicine, and we happen to be from the same class in our medical school. So we teamed up, we did some basic background research, who else is going to help, and we found various teams who will be working with us. And as soon as we could do, within a week, we were there.
Wow, within a week, that's very quick, very, very short. Window of opportunity. And you were able to get donations in that short amount of time to help you?
That's right. So people were very generous in starting with a donation and pouring in money for various relief effort. Yes, even from here, locally with Upstate, as well as with other generous donors in the Syracuse area. And of course, I also use some of my personal funds also. So at least we could start something. And there were five of us, and we were also coordinating with other teams also.
There were other teams already on the ground there that you began to work with?
Some of our contacts who were there in Nepal were already starting that process. So although it sounds so... Now remembering it,
looking back,
I can't imagine how things went, but fortunately, process went smooth.
It sounds like you were in high gear, though. Mm-hmm. It sounds like this was something you were absolutely determined to do, and you were able to. So did you bring a lot of supplies with you? How did you come? How did you come armed? Obviously, you had your knowledge, and all of your colleagues came with certain medical knowledge. But did you also bring a lot of supplies with you?
That's right. So because it was an earthquake and it was a trauma-related event in terms of medical necessity, I approached our clinic here. I have to tell Dr. Lehman, he is also one of the professors in our department. He helped me a lot, as well as... SOS, which is an orthopedic group here in town, they provided me with a lot of supplies, more than that I could carry.
Wow.
And then once I got those, I had to talk to the airlines to waive the fee so that I could carry them with me. Similarly, my other friends also did this exact same thing. So we were well equipped by the time we landed in Kathmandu.
So you were born in Nepal.
That's
and
right.
Trained as a physician there. Tell us a little bit about where you came from.
I was born in, it is called western side of Nepal, which is 150 miles west of the capital city, Kathmandu. I did my education until medical school there, and then came to the United States 10 years ago to do a residency, and ever since I've been working here in the United States. Fortunately, the part I come from was shaken, but it was not severely affected.
Oh, so it was shaken, you said, but
yes, not even.
The destruction didn't really happen there.
Fortunately, that's not.
So would you still have a lot of family there?
I do have almost most of my relatives, friend. They are there. And fortunately, they were in that part where there was only tremors. And
wow.
But
so they
damaged.
They escaped the worst of it. So did you worry about the danger?
I did. Actually, the other thing was, even when I contacted some of my other family members, they told me not to come because there were still aftershock coming on. And one thing that we know about earthquake is not only the first tremor, the big shock that damages, but the aftershock is also as important, which can cause further damage. So, yes, there were a lot of dangers. And especially for us who were going into this severely affected part, I can tell you a lot of things, but yes, the biggest one was the collapsing building, the weak building, and of course Nepal is a mountainous country, so dry landslide was also rampant when.
So you had a lot of dry land. I mean, earthquakes cause, as you say, tremendous destruction. So
right.
You saw the buildings that collapsed. So tell us, when you arrived, you went to a center of where the greatest damage occurred. Is that it? Because that was where the greatest need was.
Yes, I and my team, when we went to actually not the epicenter of the earthquake, but the epicenter of the damage.
Okay, not the epicenter of the earthquake, but of the damage. So when you got there, what did you see?
So it feels so different, just by. I have gone to Nepal so many times in the last 10 years. I never felt this way. It looked so deserted. The capital city had no charm. The traffic was very less. I've never seen that less traffic.
It was kind of like desolate?
Yeah, something like that. And then going to this particular place in a district called Sindhupalchok, where most of the damage happened, there's no standing structure. Everything is down in the ground with rubbles. So it feels like as if this was a doomsday movie where you are part of it.
A doomsday movie, yeah. No, I can gather that. But when you first arrived, the earthquake had already happened and most of the aftershocks were gone, except then there was a second, not real earthquake, but another large aftershock while you were there.
Well, people are saying it was a different earthquake.
A different earthquake.
At least because the magnitude was 7.3, which in itself can cause tremendous damage.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Dinesh Subedi. He's an assistant professor of medicine at Upstate Medical University, and we're talking about his recent medical mission to earthquake-devastated Nepal, his country of origin. So tell us what you did.
So our focus was more in health of the people, because that's what I can do something about.
Those were your skills.
Right. So then we immediately started medical camps.
So you set up small medical camps, more than one?
What we did is we went through all those places in the first 4 or 5 days of our Nepal trip, and we teamed up with some other folks who also had some supplies. Then we actually did a like a village to village visit. So we go to a village, see patient, 25, 30 patient at a time, then go to another one, then go to another, and then go to another one. So it was like a hiking all day to different villages and taking care of the patient as much as we could.
What kind of medical problems were you finding?
So we were anticipating a lot of trauma patients, but fortunately, right. One thing I have to really applaud our government, that the first trauma patient who were critically ill were already evacuated.
Wow. So what you're saying is that the people who may have been injured by falling debris or they were inside of edifices, they were already evacuated to maybe a high intensity.
To a better center.
Yeah. And so you were doing more general medical care. So what kinds of things were you finding?
Yeah, that was my expertise. And we have other friends with some surgical background also. So our focus was trauma. Like a blunt trauma, one of the patients had a big swelling in her eye when, and there was a wound which was infected. So we could give her a sort of IV antibiotics, started one extra dose, as well as we could do some surgical debridement.
Debridement. So you were doing basically acute care for people who had been injured, but maybe not as severely injured as those that needed evacuation.
That's right. So we were prepared for anything worse, but fortunately, that's something that I can say is things were a little better than what we anticipated.
So you basically went from village to village and saw 20 to 30 patients a day. I mean, in each village, I'm sorry. And you would see, how many villages would you visit in a day?
So we could maybe six or seven.
Six or seven, wow.
Seven in a day.
And you were hiking, as you said, it's a very mountainous country, so you were doing a lot of hiking with supplies?
With supplies, and there are some roads also, but what happened is there were a lot of landslides, the dry landslide I was talking earlier.
Dry landslides, so the roads were blocked, so you almost had to be on foot a lot of the time?
There would be some means of transportation in between, but most of our visit was on foot.
Now, I heard that you did something else, though. After you kind of did a lot of the medical stuff, you recognized the need to try to reconstruct some of the buildings. So you got engaged in actual building. Is that true as well?
Yeah. So after doing 1 week of medical camp, then what we realized is people's health will only be better once they have a good place to live, at least some place like a shelter. Until we can fix that, we're not going to make them healthy. So that is the current focus, which is ongoing, we started thinking like engineers, that how to build a building.
So you started out as medical people and you ended up as contractors. I mean, building contractors. You ended up building using corrugated materials and actually building shelters for people. Right. Why is sanitation so important? Because I know that was a big focus as well.
Yeah, we had experience from a previous earthquake in all over the world. The last major one was in Haiti in 2010. That caused a lot of communicable disease outbreak, and that was our greatest fear.
So the fear was things like cholera, typhoid, and parasites as a result of poor sanitation, as a result of the destruction of whatever standard living conditions were.
Yes, so that was our main focus. So as much as we could, we could prevent and that was our goal. So that's why what we did is whenever we get a chance, we always spoke to the people there, talked about the importance of sanitation, and people were very receptive also.
So that was one of the
reasons that we're not seeing that much of a problem now. So I'm fortunate to say that the experience with Haiti taught us a lot.
Haiti taught you a lot. So in the very few seconds left, you were doing a lot of building. It sounds like a Herculean task for the amount of time you were there, which was like 15 days. What do you hope will happen now?
The hope is that it will continue to be better. There is a lot of reconstruction that needs to be done. And our focus is, and the only mission for now, is to rebuild Nepal.
Are you going back again?
I am actively working with an organization, and whenever I get a chance, I'll be there.
Unbelievable. Well, thanks so much for sharing this story. My guest has been Dr. Dinesh Subedi, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Upstate Medical University, and just sharing his story about the work he's done in Nepal. Next up, when that scary-sounding croup turns scary, what to do? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Croup, a common childhood illness, can sound very scary and can even land a child in the emergency room in more severe cases. Here with more on this and what you need to know is Dr. Jennifer Need, pediatric hospitalist at Upstate Golisano's Children's Hospital and assistant professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Need. Thank you for coming in. So what exactly is croup, and why is it very scary for parents?
Sure. Croup is an infection of the upper airway that occurs in children, and it's very scary because children have a cough that sounds like a barky cough, like a dog or a seal, and that can be very scary. And children can also develop respiratory distress where they struggle to breathe, and that can be very scary for families as well.
Yes, so I read somewhere that this idea of the barking cough really comes from the fact that the airways are constricted. Mm-hmm. So it's like when you're blowing air through a smaller space, it creates noise. In this case, with the cough, it sounds like a barking cough. And the breathing, even when they inspire, breathe in, it's almost like a whistling sound that's called stridor. Or something like that.
Yeah, that's correct. The stridor is very commonly heard in croup, and so it's a high pitched sound that's heard most often during inspiration, and it occurs because the upper airway is narrowed from so much swelling, and so the airflow is more turbulent. It doesn't flow through as easy.
So, what actually causes croup?
The most common cause. Are viruses, and that's the focus of what I'll be talking about today is viral infectious croup. There are other causes, but in children, the most common cause is a virus.
And there are multiple viruses that can cause it?
That's correct. Parainfluenza is the most common virus, but there are many other viruses that can cause croup. Viruses such as respiratory syncytial virus, abbreviated as RSV, rhinovirus, adenovirus, handful of viruses can definitely cause croup.
So a child might be exposed to any number of viruses, as they all are, whether they're in daycare or in school or what have you, and that any of those viruses could end up with symptoms of croup, basically progressing to a situation of croup.
That is correct. The respiratory viruses are the most common cause of croup, and croup is an illness caused by viruses. So some viruses might just cause a cold. Other viruses may just cause a cold, but in addition, affect the upper airway. And when the upper airway is affected a certain way, that's croup. So croup is a broader term for a disease that can be caused by various viruses.
So who gets this? Who's most at risk for this disease?
Younger children are. The common age range is 6 months through 3 years, with a peak around 2 years. However, children up to 6 years can be affected.
And when do we see it occurring? Are there times of the year? Is it seasonal?
It is seasonal. It occurs more commonly in the fall and winter months.
Which makes sense, because that's often when the colds are around.
Right.
But why do some children, for example, or are some children more susceptible to going to the point of croup versus just having the cold symptoms?
Right. With any virus, some children will have a more mild form of the illness, where other children will be affected more and have a more severe presentation, so can have more severe forms. Again, it depends on the virus and the strain of the virus in terms of what disease develops. Some children get a cough from a virus, other children can get a viral pneumonia, and some children can get croup.
So basically, how serious is it, basically? I mean, we've said in the beginning it's very common. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can occur after, you know, just as being exposed to some kind of common everyday virus like RSV or things that are generally seen in children. So how serious, though, is it in most cases?
Right. Again, children may have a more mild, moderate, or severe form. And so I would say in the more moderate and severe forms, then those children may be sicker with respiratory distress and require evaluation by a pediatrician. So in those cases, it can be more serious. As in any virus, a lot of times children just have mild symptoms. Most people know what a croupy cough is. Again, it sounds like a dog or a seal, and that's something that can be managed at home as long as children aren't in respiratory distress.
So the key here is the difference, and we're going to get to that mm-hmm. a little bit about exactly what are the criteria that you would use in terms of actually contacting your
Correct.
Medical professional. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with pediatrician Dr. Jennifer Need. We're talking about what you need to know about croup. Well, let's get back to exactly you've already told me a little bit about what it looks like, but tell us about the progression of the disease. I mean, for example, what are the initial signs in terms of what you would see as a parent or a caregiver? And then the course of the disease, how does it usually progress?
Sure. So children, again, viruses are the most common cause. So children will often have nonspecific cold symptoms during the first few days of the illness. And so the cold symptoms include cough, runny nose, sore throat, low-grade fever. And then as the virus goes on and causes irritation and swelling of the upper airway, you can think of it as the breathing tube, children will develop a barky cough. So again, it sounds like a dog or a seal. The stridor, which is that high-pitched, often inspiratory sound, as well as respiratory distress. So children may be breathing faster than normal, seem like they're struggling to breathe, or using more muscles, like extra muscles, to breathe. And it's not uncommon for the fever to be higher during the days when the barky cough and the stridor and the difficulty breathing are occurring.
So that can be very scary for parents, I would think.
Yes.
So you mentioned that some of these are more mild and can mm-hmm. remain at home. Mm-hmm. Others need to be seen by a professional and possibly even hospitalized on occasion, rare occasion, but even on occasion. So tell us about treatment first, and then I want to talk a little bit about more specifically when you have to contact a physician.
Sure. So again, croup is most often caused by a virus, and so the treatment for a virus is really supportive. So making sure a child gets rest and stays hydrated. And it's also important to realize time is the biggest factor for a virus to resolve. So it does take time for children to get better and for the illness to run its course. So if a child has a croupy cough and some cold symptoms and otherwise seems to be doing okay, not having that stridor sound or respiratory distress, then they can most likely just stay at home, and parents can manage the illness similar to how they would the common cold.
So that's the question. In terms of managing, what mm-hmm. are the kinds of things they can do? You're not supposed to give antibiotics, because antibiotics are for bacterial infection. And you'd say in most cases, croup is caused in children by a virus.
Correct. So antibiotics.
What can you give?
Antibiotics are not effective. Again, rest, hydration. Historically, people have probably heard about putting a child in a steam environment or a cool mist environment, such as taking the child into the bathroom with the shower running and letting them breathe in the steam, or taking them out into the cool air at night.
I know evidence, not to interrupt you, but that was a major point that was made to me by my pediatrician many years ago. Mm-hmm. My children are now adults, but during the time I was raising my children, that was a very strong recommendation. To put them in a shower, turn the shower on high, and have the steam there. And that evidence doesn't seem to support that.
Yeah,
though.
The current evidence in the literature does not support that cool mist or that steam therapy. However, there is anecdotal reports that some families find that it is helpful. So some medical providers will still recommend it. I don't routinely recommend it just because the evidence doesn't support it at this time. That being said, if it seems to help a child and it's not harmful, then I'm fine if parents will try those things. I do want to say that sometimes that steam from the shower or just taking a kid out into the cool evening, that can be more upsetting to the child, and they might start crying, and that worsens the respiratory distress, that stridor sound, the difficulty breathing. So in that case, if people notice where it's not helpful and it's actually more harmful because the child's getting upset, I definitely would not continue it.
I think that's a key point. So it's really on a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. The steam alone is not harmful, or the cold air is not harmful, but if it distresses the child, that can be harmful.
Right, and keeping in mind that the current evidence doesn't really support it.
So when a child, so when they're having a high fever, though, what else do you recommend? I mean, you said as you would for any common cold.
Right, and so with fever, Tylenol or Motrin, you know, for children greater than 6 months are antipyretics, so fever relief.
And relievers. Never aspirin, is that still the
case?
That's
correct.
And why is that?
So we do not recommend aspirin in the setting, or especially in the setting of a viral illness, because kids can become very sick from it. And we used to see something called Reye's syndrome.
So basically Tylenol or Motrin would be the recommended medication of choice for a high fever if your child was staying at home and just waiting it out and using supportive therapy. But how about those few children that need to go to get some more help? Let's go to this first. So when do you need to see your doctor, and when do you need to perhaps go to the ED?
Sure. So I would take your child in to see the doctor if the symptoms, the barky cough, and the symptoms are going on for greater than a week. Usually after the barky cough starts, there's a peak of symptoms for a couple days, and then the child will start to get better. So if the child does not seem to be getting better according to that timeline. The other time that it's important to seek medical care is if the child's having that stridor sound, that high-pitched inspiratory sound, as well as respiratory distress. So they're breathing harder, they're struggling to breathe, the parents notice they're using muscles that they normally don't use to breathe. And that would indicate respiratory distress, where they should see a medical provider.
And in that case, what's the treatment then?
If a child is in respiratory distress, they will typically get two treatments, a breathing treatment. It's a nebulized treatment called racemic epinephrine, and also a dose of steroids, typically a steroid called dexamethasone. Both medications decrease airway swelling and allow the child to breathe easier. The reason that both are given is that the racemic epinephrine acts very quickly, but it only lasts a couple hours. And the steroids take longer to work. But once the racemic epinephrine wears off, the steroids will be effective in the body, and the steroids last much longer, so last up to 2.5 days.
And
so that's the reason both are given.
And so those are really the treatment of choice, and generally children stay in the hospital just a few days?
That's correct. A child, usually in the emergency setting, a child will get a racemic epinephrine treatment and a dose of steroids, and they'll be watched for several hours to make sure once the racemic epinephrine effect wears off, they breathe comfortably with those steroids effective in the body. Some children will develop respiratory distress again and require a second racemic epinephrine treatment, and those children are typically admitted to the hospital for close monitoring just to make sure they don't continue to receive racemic epinephrine or require racemic epinephrine treatments. It's important to point out that we do not prescribe racemic epinephrine for home. So if a child needs that, they need to be in the hospital setting.
Very good. So basically, though it's common, rarely there are more severe cases, and even more rare, there can be some complications. So if you suspect problems with breathing, contact your health professional.
That's correct.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Jennifer Need, pediatric hospitalist at Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital and assistant professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. For some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Emergency physician William Paolo is with us to tell us what to do for a cut.
So cuts are not a one-size-fits-all kind of disease. Lots of different mechanisms to cause cuts, some dirty, some clean, and lots of different anatomical locations. The first thing, if you are responding or yourself have become cut, is to control bleeding. Now, bleeding isn't always determined by how deep a cut is or how bad a cut is, and people will see different things when they get cut. Certain parts of the body have a lot more fat underneath it. So by way of example, if you get cut in the palm of your hand, there's a lot of padding and a lot of fat. So you're bound to see a lot of fat there. If you get cut in your scalp, the scalp is very vascular. You're bound to see a lot of bleeding. This doesn't really determine how bad or how severe the cut is. It's just depending upon where you got cut. So the first thing that you need to do is control bleeding. And how you control bleeding is with pressure. There's an old adage in the emergency department that's all bleeding stops eventually. Now, obviously, we don't want to get you to the point where you've run out of blood to stop bleeding. So the first thing that you'll do is hold pressure. And pressure is really a long period of time. We're talking a good 5 minutes of holding pressure without peaking. That peaking decreases the rate of being able to form a clot. So after you've done that and the bleeding is controlled, you can kind of take a look at your cut and determine where it is. So different cuts have different rates of severity. So again, like I said, scalp lacerations bleed a lot and often need to be either sutured or stapled to kind of get back under control of that bleeding. But really what we're looking at from a medical perspective is we're looking at how gaping a wound is. The more the wound edges stick apart from one another, the more likely it is it's going to scar because the body is going to try to pull those edges closer and closer. So certainly cuts that don't look that significant on the face, we often care about those a lot more because we can pull them back together without the body having to do the extra work that forms scar tissue. So you care about them more on the face. Other areas of cut that you can get in the hand. What I worry about when you get cuts in the hand, the extremity, is if you have any concomitant symptoms. So what I mean by that is you feel numbness. That may mean that you've actually lacerated a nerve if it's become deep enough. The final thing to say, after you've dealt with all of the basic stuff, even if a cut didn't need suturing, if you could deal with it at home because it's not very gaping and you've controlled the bleeding, it may have to worry about your tetanus status. Now, the thing with tetanus shots is we say for clean wounds, so that's the kind of, I'm cutting a bagel with a knife and I've cut my finger. That's considered a clean wound. Your tetanus shot is good for 10 years. For dirty wounds, so I'm working out on a construction site and a piece of equipment cut me, that's only good for 5 years. So depending upon the last time of your tetanus shot, it may mean you want to get to see your either emergency department provider or your primary care provider or your family practitioner sooner rather than later. So the steps you would take, number one, control bleeding. Number two, assess the cut. Where is it? Is there any other symptoms with it? Number three, kind of take a look if you can. You won't be able to really determine depth because a lot of different things will determine that. But take a look at how gaping it is. And then number four, think about your tetanus status. Some cuts that are not very big and bleeding is controlled, not very gaping, you can treat at home. I recommend using bacitracin 2 to 3 times a day. The others, come take a, let a professional take a look at it, either in your doctor's office or at the emergency department.
Coming up next, the evolving story of hospice and the comfort it can provide to dying patients and their families. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Thank you. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of June 28th. Embrace your creative side. Recent research shows that cultural activities, such as going to a museum exhibit or creating an art display, increase happiness and satisfaction in life, while decreasing depression and anxiety. Activities that involve being active in the creative process are more beneficial than passive and receptive activities like watching television. This week, experiment with a creative activity that interests you. It can be anything from photography or painting to arranging flowers or singing. So explore your creative side and have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Palliative care and the hospice movement has grown in this country and worldwide. But how has it affected the end of life for patients and their families? Joining us with some answers is Dr. Judy Setla. She's the Medical Director of Hospice of Central New York. Welcome, Dr. Setla. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start by defining what we mean when we say palliative care and hospice care. What are they? What is the mission?
The mission of both hospice and palliative medicine is pretty simple. It's essentially to relieve the suffering that people have with either acute serious illness, illness that may be threatening their life, or for those who are actually at the end of their life.
And is the idea here that it doesn't try to either hasten death or postpone it, but see it as a normal part of the whole life cycle?
Yeah, that's historically been the hospice philosophy and statement over the last decades. But as I'll mention a little later, there's been some interesting research about hospice and palliative medicine in that it's very clear that it is probably not speeding death along, and in fact, there's a fair amount of research that suggests addition of palliative care to serious illness treatment may actually lengthen life.
So the goal is really to have the best quality of life for patients and their families for as long as life exists.
Absolutely.
And that symptoms, control of pain, whether it be psychological pain or, you know, frank physical pain, is a high priority.
That's the key goal. Yes.
So when and how did all this begin?
Well, hospice, the model of hospice, was conceptualized and started by a woman in Britain by the name of Cicely Saunders. And in World War II, she trained as a nurse, but became injured and had to retrain as a social worker. She went out to work as a medical social worker, and she met a Polish refugee, and his name was David Tasma, and he was dying of cancer. And she was appalled at how he was treated at the end of life. He was essentially ignored, put in a corner of the hospital, and his various types of physical pain, psychological pain, were essentially ignored. Cicely Saunders went on to become a physician, ultimately, because she could not get the medical system in Britain to address the pain of dying patients. And she spent the next decades of her life creating the model of interdisciplinary care to address all the types of suffering that humans endure, which is physical pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain, and just, you know, grief and suffering.
So she set up the first actual hospice. When was that?
Well, she set up St. Christopher's Hospice, which is a place. It's a location in London, and that was in the 1960s. And within 3 years, she actually developed a home care program, which is now the key model across the world. And her hospice was unique in that it not only took care of dying patients, but she did rigorous research on opioid medications and began doing teaching of medical students, nurses, social workers, etc.
So then, since that time, the hospice movement and palliative care, or the concept of palliative medicine, has really grown worldwide. Isn't that the case?
It has. It's been adopted much more in Western countries, and frankly, the growth was very slow to start. The concepts moved here to the States, and then some demonstration projects through Medicare showed that it was successful and well-liked by families. And we still continue in hospices across the country to enjoy a 95% plus rating of approval by families after our services are over. So the Medicare benefit was created in the 1980s, but really in the last decade, I'd say there's been a marked increase in the use of services as more people are aging, the baby boomers are entering, and more recognition of the services that are available for people at end of life, and people also wanting to maybe not spend as much time in hospitals, waiting for doctor visits, and being tested in treatment forever.
Especially if they're in a terminal illness situation.
Sure, or, you know, and the later in illness, as the organs get more damaged, testing and treatment offer less and less to a highly damaged body. And so we are an alternative to returning for what is often less and less effective treatment within the medical system.
So what, if any, differences exist then in this whole concept of hospice versus palliative care?
Well, the original model, as Saunders created it, was really for hospice. When the United States adopted the model and allowed Medicare patients to choose that as part of the Medicare benefit as an alternative, and now most private insurances and Medicaid also offer the benefit, in the U.S., we were, as usual, concerned about the cost of care. And so in the U.S., hospice was restricted to those who had a presumed six-month or less prognosis, meaning that they are expected to live less than 6 months. There is no other country who has that restriction on hospice services, but it exists here in America. For those who have a prognosis greater than 6 months, or who are expected to survive, let's say somebody who has a serious car accident, a young person, and they're quite ill, they're in an ICU for a month, but they are expected to recover, then palliative medicine is the term that is used for those who have an expected prognosis of getting back to living or maybe having years of life left.
And how is that care different or similar to what hospice would offer?
The model is essentially designed to be very similar to hospice. In this country right now, though, palliative care teams are primarily located in hospitals because the hospitals subsidize the work of those teams, which include physicians, nurses, and social workers who have expertise.
But under that circumstance, the idea of a potential return to life or a longer course of life, what makes palliative care different than just standard hospital care?
The palliative
sets
care
it apart.
The palliative care teams in hospitals, or those of us who accept patients at end of life, have the same goals. We're trained the same way, and our focus is relief of suffering. That's our focus. So intense treatment of pain, nausea, vomiting, depression, anxiety, spiritual distress. Those are the things that palliative care and hospice focus on, while the rest of the medical system is looking at traditional treatments for the illnesses or the injuries that people have sustained.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with Hospice of Central New York Medical Director Dr. Judy Setla, and we're talking about hospice and palliative care and what it has offered to people and families, patients and families. So very quickly, tell me, what are the services that are available? You mentioned interdisciplinary. Who are members of the team, mm-hmm. hospice or palliative care, and what do they do?
So the model is basically highly, what we call high touch, low tech, and it's mostly people that are helping people work through the issues at hand. So when a person enrolls at hospice, that means that they are enrolled in their home or wherever they live, and a team, which includes an RN, who is the case manager, the go-to person for everything, is kind of the circus leader of the group. There's a social worker. There's a physician like myself available for advice or for visits for symptom management. We have volunteers to help out families with things that need to be done, home health aides that can come in the home and do the heavy work that's personal care. We have chaplains to provide spiritual counseling if patients or families want them. And after a person passes, hospices across the country provide over a year of grief counseling, if desired, by whoever the patient calls family.
So the families clearly benefit as well as the patient.
Yeah, and in that this was model. That's right. That was unique to Cicely Saunders' model, was instead of the most of the medical system where the patient is the unit of care, in palliative medicine, we view the patient and whoever they consider family to be the unit of care, and we need to make sure that we are addressing the suffering in those people as well.
So how is the decision made to ask for hospice care? I mean, what are the parameters? Who's eligible?
Everybody's eligible, and anyone can actually call a hospice and ask if they can be considered for enrollment, so families can refer themselves. Then the process requires that two physicians must approve that they appear to have a limited prognosis of 6 months or less.
That's for hospice as opposed to this idea
that's
of palliative
for hospice
care.
As opposed to palliative care. And so we would get permission from the family to get records from their key physicians, and then a hospice physician like me has to review those records, and if both of those look like the person has a limited lifespan, and if they are wishing to kind of forego the vast majority of acute care in hospitals repeatedly going back and forth, then we can enroll them. A lot of our visits are for information. There's no obligation when our team comes out and talks to people to enroll. People can enroll at any time. We often see people enroll after two or three visits, and people are free to leave hospice on any given day, and then they can re-enroll if they wanted.
And how frequently are these visits? Not the information gathering ones, mm-hmm. but once you start basically disseminating care. Is it a daily kind of thing?
So what happens is the RNs begin a weekly nursing visit, working with the primary caregiver who is necessary for a person to have hospice, somebody within the family or a friend in charge of connecting for the most part with hospice. The social workers, chaplains come on appointment basis. Physicians make appointments and come. It's important to realize we don't just move in and take over care. That's not what we're designed to do. And we do also provide such services in nursing homes, and that's what happens with some people who require that care, or Francis House, our close partner in the community who provides a shelter for dying patients.
What challenges or stumbling blocks do you find for people to ask for these services? I mean, are there financial ones that people are in denial, medical doctors not referring, families are resistant? What are the things you find?
A lot of those come into play, especially in Central New York. We have some of the lowest rates of hospice referral in the country right here in Central New York. In terms of a stumbling block for hospice, there's very little because our services are paid for entirely by Medicare. There's not even any copay. Private insurance is pretty much similar with a few variations, so it's usually not cost. Our services are free to eligible patients. But people don't want to admit that they have a limited lifespan. It frightens them to kind of think of this. And we also know that this community in particular has a culture of treating a lot, treating to the very end. And specialists, both in cancer and non-cancer, have a responsibility to consider to think about end-of-life care for not just cancer, but lung patients, emphysema, heart failure, and those with dementia.
And also this whole idea of being able to treat the whole family so everyone comes through that experience,
yes,
in a sense lifted,
yes,
or supported. Well, a lot of it and very important information. Thank you so much for coming in. I think you really shed a tremendous amount of light, and hopefully there will be more utilization. I think maybe as the baby boomers become eligible, perhaps they'll bring some enlightenment to the situation. Thanks so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Judy Settler. She's the Medical Director of Hospice of Central New York. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Now that spring and summer are finally here and within reach, it's easy to have a kind thought for winter's harshness. Paula Schultz is a poet in Wisconsin, known for their fierce winters, and I've promised myself to put this poem, Winter Drifting, on my refrigerator next fall, so when I start complaining about the snow, I'll remember its potential for good. Here is Winter Drifting. In the white quiet of snow, I can travel far from myself. Scrappings of sky fall like crumbs from a soap carving project for children. I can walk into fog, become mild as milk. I've learned to leave sorrows loud as primary colors, and problems turning round and round in my head like the mixer's always rethought ridges, because you can't climb out of that bowl by thinking. I can let each rumination become as pale and insubstantial as these slight drifting flakes. I can walk back to myself. I can begin again.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we explore a new procedure for enlarged prostates, plus the continuing danger of lead for our kids, and depression in healthcare professionals, a real concern. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.